Better Spaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome back to InterSpaces, the science podcast of ZIF, a center for interdisciplinary research based at Bielefeld University. I'm Caroline May and look forward to today's episode. Okay, maybe you could introduce yourselves again, although you already did that. But for those listeners who maybe haven't listened to episode 2, which they can of course do after this one.
I'm Clive Oppenheimer. I'm a professor of volcanology at the University of Cambridge and a filmmaker in my spare time.
My name is Ulf Bündgen, and I joined Clive in Cambridge at the Department of Geography 8 years ago as a professor of environmental systems analysis, so physical geography with a focus on dendrochronology and climatology and ecology.
You've been here at ZIF as part of the research group Volcanoes, Climate and History, which took place from November 2021 until January 24. And during your time, you have been not only researching, but you've filmed the research project or the outcome. Or maybe you could tell us something about that.
Sure. When we established the project, we also saw an opportunity to make a film which would involve filming conversations with some of the fellows who joined us at the workshops. Each of those workshops followed a particular theme: climate, archaeology, history. And so we would film half a dozen or so of our guest fellows at each of these workshops. And then it took a bit longer than originally planned. So actually after about a year after we'd finished the project, we had the film complete sort of around summer earlier this year. And it's a story about the volcanoes and how they affect the climate and how we can trace the impacts of volcanically instigated climate change, the impacts that has on crops and pasture, then has a knock-on impact on society. So that's why this topic engages with history and archaeology. So the film looks at that trajectory, but it also explores how does collaboration work and why do we need places like ZIF in order to bring scholars from different disciplines together to exchange ideas and learn from each other's experience across the epistemological divides, you know, between the humanities and the social sciences and the natural sciences.
Was it more like a protocol of your research, or was it a part of it that had an effect on the research itself? What would you say?
I would say the film, it was an integral part of our workshops. We would, to some extent, suspend activities for half a day during the workshops so that we could film with individual participants. And in the meantime, we might run an art workshop with Anna Gudjonsdottir, Icelandic artist, to occupy those who weren't immediately involved in the filming. And Anna herself became an integral part of our core group, somewhat by happenstance. Her art was in the institute when we first arrived in November 2021, and we brought her into the group, and she stayed with us through our workshops. With her experience as an artist, actually also, I think, shaping our discussions that we had. I would say it was integrated with the exchange and with the other outputs from the group, which included more conventional publications.
Yeah, I agree with everything Clive said. So we had the idea to make a film right from the beginning when we submitted the proposal. We had no idea how that film would look. But we have the same if we are thinking about publications. And that was when we have these workshops, when we gather the colleagues, even when we select them in the very early stage, whom do we want to invite and with whom do we want to share the physical and intellectual space at ZIF throughout these week-long workshops, we have in mind that we want to produce a publication. We don't know how this publication will look. We don't even know the title or the topic, but we know we want to have a publication. So that, I think we cannot deny that this has an effect on each step somehow. And with the film, it was the same. So I think that was, for me, the first experience to do it. So it had no direct effect on how we worked, but it was always in the back of at least Clive and my head that we wanted this product, we wanted a product at the end. So I think there was an impact, an influence on somehow on our behavior and also on the fellow guests that we invited. They were aware of that. And we spoke about that yesterday a little bit, that we were very successful in inviting very good people. And maybe one of the reasons was also that we advertised a little bit. We said, look, and one of the days, a Tuesday, we're going to use for filming. And that is maybe an additional plus point, a benefit, because the scholars are not used to that. And it added, I think, a little bit of diversity also to the entire program.
So not every person likes to talk in front of a camera. Was that ever a problem, or did you select the people who were comfortable with it?
No, I think clearly there are people who are familiar or particularly outgoing who are not fazed. I think it's a very discomforting experience for most people to have, you know, not just a regular camera, but a camera that looks serious with lots of knobs on it and lenses, and maybe a second camera and lights, and a microphone has been stuffed up their shirt. It's not a comfortable experience, I think, for most people. And so I find when I approach filming a conversation in these circumstances, my role is to elicit the best performance from our protagonist. And that means doing as much as you can to help them to feel relaxed and not intimidated by the camera. And it's one of the reasons, it's a bit pedantic, but I talk about having a conversation, not an interview. It's not a, you know, sticking a microphone, tell me, how did you feel when you found this result? It's more of a dialogue, and I'm off camera, but it's really a conversation, and we happen to be filming it. So ideally, the subject should not notice anymore that the camera is on them or that the microphone is itching their neck. They should just feel that they can get into the conversation. I would say one of the other challenges is, you know, nearly all of our protagonists are scholars who are in universities where they're used to lecturing for an hour. So this is always a challenge with experts who want to answer even a simple question with, you know, about 28 sub-clauses. And so that's another thing you're trying to manage a little bit.
How's your experience not being a filmmaker?
Yeah, I mean, Clive did all of the filming and everything that I saw, and at no time had doubt that this was very, very good. And the way of how Clive is approaching our colleagues for such a purpose, I think that's brilliant. And that is also a reason why the end product is what it is. I think it really comes a lot down to Clive's experience and way how he is engaging with the individual people and gives them space and it takes a lot out. And I noticed that not only during the filming that I observed from distance a little bit, because I had to be very quiet and not disturb the setting. We filmed everything here at ZIF in the foyer, which is a beautiful space. So we actually came in advance with the film team from Cologne that Clive is working with since many years. And then to think where and how do we want to have the conversations to take place? Because we knew we need them at the end for a high-end product. So all these things matter, right? And then it was the foyer with the light, and we had that continuously throughout the workshop. So there is somehow a red line. And what I wanted to say is actually that Clive engaged with the protagonists, so with our scholars, so with the fellows, throughout the days also before the conversations, the filming. So that people felt actually comfortable. It was not, we were not throwing them ins kalte Wasser, how we would say. So there was somehow a way, and also I think the atmosphere we were able to create here was very open and friendly and gave everyone a lot of confidence. And all these things contributed to a fantastic set of, I think these are more than 30 small film or individual footages, conversations we recorded.
Just one detail, you talked about the space where we filmed, the foyer upstairs at the Institute. As I looked at the footage working in the editing, I really loved the background. Is beautiful. It's a wonderful framing, actually, for these conversations, architecturally and sometimes with the art blurred because it's out of field. But the light as well, sometimes we're filming into the evening, and even in an interview, the light is changing, the interior lights are coming on, the sunset sky is lighting up. And in a lot of film situations, this is the last thing you want. You want to have, you know, very standard illumination and no changes that can affect the filming speed and so on. But for me, actually, this added an extra dimension, this really interesting architectural space and the framing of our subjects.
I have another point I wanted. I think when I'm now reflecting on it, and also when seeing the film more often, I think we missed out on, we could have filmed a little bit more, in fact we haven't filmed at all, from the workshop itself. There are one or two scenes in the movie that you put in where you can see the group discussing or sitting. That comes very short in. I think for us, we do that every day, so it's not really exciting. But I can see an additional value for a wider audience that is not familiar with the academic life. I know you cannot fake them and you don't want to film the entire week, right? What happens in the lecture room or in the discussion room. But I think one could have thought a little bit more of integrating parts and that. And there is this one moment where Anna Gudjonsdottir said, like, and I realized the value or the importance of the image. And I think we do have the slides, I think, of many of the presentations. And there is an aesthetic value and also an informative value of how we engage and discuss and how discussions work and what we then reflect on the screen. I think maybe for a future project, not a lot, but like a little bit of including that. What do you think?
I think in hindsight, there are a few little things I would have filmed. I would have filmed the coffee machine because it gets, you know, when you think about it, most of us are coffee drinkers or tea drinkers. Our scholastic work is fueled by, you know, a narcotic substance. And, it, you know, so the coffee machine is quite an integral part of Ziff. So you know, one of the things on my mind when I came to Ziff is, can I get the counters? Can I get I've always wanted to have one, or better, two of these counters to operate the coffee machine so I can get a double shot in the mug. Little things like that. I wish I'd filmed maybe in the elevator going up. There's this beautiful elevator in a sort of cylinder that goes up to the first floor. The helipad. I mean, I mentioned the helipad, but I didn't actually film it. There are some little details. The swimming pool. The swimming pool is particularly beautiful. There are woods behind the Institute. I came, one of the visits, there was snow on the ground. It was very, very beautiful. I think it may have been in the morning. I went out at dawn. The snow on the ground, the trees are bare. Somebody was in the pool, so the light was on, and it's up on the first floor. It looked just beautiful, actually, some of the light, the blue light and the snow and the grey sky. And yeah, I didn't want it to be a cinema verite, you know, that we're following people into the dining room and this kind of thing. But it would have been helpful to have had one or two other little details of space here.
The audience for a film is a bit different, a bit wider than for scientific papers, for example, or in comparison. How does that affect the work? How do you choose what to film and what information to present and what maybe to simplify or leave out?
So I think the commonality between writing a paper and making a film is storytelling. I mean, both are storytelling. And for a paper, of course, there are quite formulaic rules for how it's structured. It has an abstract, it has a title, it has an introduction and results discussion and conclusions. But in a paper, you're telling a story. You're telling a story for an audience, for a readership. You want them to get the take-home message. So it has a narrative arc to it as a film. So I think that's something that's in common. For me, when I think about film, perhaps I think more about, okay, this is a film about volcanoes, climate and history, but what's it really about? And in this case, it's about cooperation and communities and collaboration and being able to have interdisciplinary conversations. So that's more the red thread of the film rather than a particular volcano or a particular time in history or a particular methodology.
The audience is not written in stone, huh? So the audience is flexible and also can be defined slightly by us, right? It's the same with a paper. I mean, we have said often that we have the results, we have the interpretation, then we start to think about which story do we want to tell. So there is a big element, and I'm always saying that with the glass half empty, half full. So that would be the same result. It is one glass of water, but you can tell two different stories with the same results, and not one is wrong, right? So, and we then also define a little bit the audience. For a publication, we would say, out, where do we publish that? In which journal? Having in mind slightly different audiences. So if it is a very broad journal, very interdisciplinary, then it's a different, likely a different audience of non-experts, more non-experts than if we would aim for a very topical journal that is read by a very well-defined community. So there are nuances of playing, and I think with the film it's the same. And I think until now, at least, I'm not able to say what kind of film is that really. And that tells you also a little bit about the audience. I think we are still in the learning process of who will or who is the audience. And that then shows you also that we are not too much dictated by this idea. So I think we were, at least how I saw Clive working, we were not trying to please a specific audience too much, right? And that was never the aim. Maybe that's too boring also.
Who do you hope will the audience be? Do you have any expectations, or are you open to...
I think many.
Yeah, like any film, there'll be people who will not connect with it at all and people whom it'll have a real resonance. I would say if one person comes up and says, I didn't know anything about this and it's changed a little how I see the world. I hadn't thought of these connections. Or if a future student comes and says, you know, I wasn't thinking to go to university, but seeing this film and being inspired by some of the protagonists, it made me think I can do this too. Those are the kinds of rewards that you get as a filmmaker. It's not that the film is seen by 10 million people. It's connected with one person and somehow changed their lives in some way. That's the real reward of making a film.
You touched a little bit on that, but what do you think the role of film in science communication is in general?
I think it can be a whole range of things because there are many different kinds of film. There are David Attenborough, Brian Cox, and many very, very well-made, high-budget films that are very inspiring for a broad audience. Personally, I'm more interested in, the art house end of film documentary features. And as I say, I think it's partly about offering a perspective that is novel to an audience, and they do look at the world in a different way afterwards. I think here, one of the things I might hope is that it will provoke curiosity. It will stimulate, you know, a lot of school education is very siloed. You go to physics class and then you have a German class and an English class. And these things are taught as if they're disconnected. And a film like ours, I think, shows how you can have a climate modeler who spends their career coding a few lines in an enormous computational model who can talk with a historian who's working on 17th century Scandinavia, who can link up with someone who works in Greenland on ice cores, who can talk with Ulf about tree rings to piece together a new understanding of history. I think a good film should be a kind of provocation in some sense, negative or positive. I never want to be a scientist now that I've seen what they actually do. Maybe is still a kind of positive result.
I think one of the current challenges in science communication is that sometimes the audience is not as trusting of the science. For example, especially in the context of climate change, where there are the publications and people just choose to not believe. Do you think film is something that can overcome this or can help with that?
At the margins, but I think the forces of misinformation, disinformation are so powerful, and of course so many people are consuming media through social apps, that a 1 hour long film is not going to cut into a lot of the discourse that is very critical about science and scientists and universities. I think we're absolutely at the margins of what we can achieve, but it doesn't mean we should give up and stop trying.
A film is not the common product coming out of a scientific collaboration. That it's not, right? And a lot of information that the public is receiving is coming from film. They are not reading papers, right? They watch TV or see a movie or are on social media. But we don't produce these products. So, and I think that is a little bit the problem, right? Because we write papers, and these papers are also meant to somehow circulate within the scientific community. So the science communication or the outreach or the public engagement, so this interface is a very difficult one. And it comes down to the question, who is responsible for feeding this or playing at this playground? And many scientists would say, we are not responsible for that. Our job is done if the paper is written. And even the press release is not our business anymore. And then a gray zone comes, and then there is information. So I think by considering additional output formats than a book or a... Even a book is for me already a little bit moving away from an article. I think that's a good idea. It should be supplementary. So I think it would have been wrong if we would have said, look, let's have this 2-year project here and we don't write the papers, or we don't aim to do that. We produce a film. Then I think it's also not really optimal. But having that on plus is good. And we are now in the position to certainly reach to a different audience. And I agree with Clive, this is nothing compared to what is out. But you can also turn it around and say, how much is it that is now coming from us? And then you can say this is 100% increase in outcomes. Although on this side it is very small, but here it is. And if we have the opportunity to do that, and I think I was inspired by work Clive did, and then I thought, I also want to do that, right? We should do that because it's fantastic. And you are reaching a different audience. We had yesterday evening the screening here. That is different. There are different people. Even if there are the same people, we discuss it differently than if we would say, look, let's read the paper. We make a reading workshop and then we discuss it. This is different. So I see a huge value in that. It is an opportunity for us to get it a little bit right, because as I said, and I should not repeat myself, but basically most, if not everything we can consume via social media and film is not made by scientists. It's maybe that they include a scientist, but here it is really coming from a scientist. So that is good. It's good. I learned a lot, and I'm convinced that we reach different people. And now one could ask, what do we want that they learn? And it was never the idea that they know everything about our research, but they see how we do work. And yeah. I think it's a good way and it has future, and you need conditions that allow you to do that. And we had them implemented in the whole program, in the whole project, right from the beginning. I think that is also different than if you would say, look, we do the normal thing and then we do a little bit of film at the end with the smartphone and so. That is all. I mean, we see that constantly, right? And I think we see too much of that. But here it was an integral part of the whole thing right from the beginning. And you asked earlier, of course it influenced the structure of the workshop. With whom do we talk? No, I think I'm not underestimating also of how it affected our thinking and that of the final audience.
One of the things that maybe, you know, I don't think you would recognize from watching the film, but an enormous amount of work goes into it. It's very hard to estimate. The film production began with our first workshop at the end of 2021, and the edit was finished in the summer of 25. So it was going on over a long period of time, but I would say it was probably about a year's worth of work. I mean, of course, you can make some quick videos here and there, but to construct something that is cinematic, it takes a lot of research and thought, and then editing, recognizing new ways of assembling the material to form a narrative backbone.
You mentioned the role of social media in the spread of misinformation. Does it also have a role in filmmaking? For instance, also the changes within social media, like AI-generated content, or is that its own thing and you try to ignore that as much as possible?
Not personally, no. I have been on social media a bit in the past, not on it at all now. It's something I feel disconnected from. It is something I worry about with two daughters, you know, one 13 who's definitely exposed to social media. I mean, sort of more broad on the topic, this is now going back, I would say, nearly 20 years ago. I was house-sitting for a friend in the States while they were on vacation, and I was working in the house, and then I noticed that they had a gardener and the radio was playing. And it was Rush Limbaugh, who was the shock jock of the day. And I started hearing what he was saying. And he was basically saying, you know, scientists are only in it for themselves. They lie about the climate to get grant funds and to get awards, and it's all. And what I was hearing was hate speech targeting people like me, just, you know, trying to do our jobs as educators and researchers and administrators. But it was a point where I recognized actually what is going on in the outside world. That was 2007 or thereabouts. I mean, that is nothing compared to the media landscape now. Rush Limbaugh would seem incredibly tame compared with the commentators you find, podcasts and social media and so on. So it's a kind of world that I try to avoid.
Understandable. You mentioned that it was a bit unique doing this film or this project, not knowing what the outcome will be. Now that the film is finished, are you satisfied with the outcome, or are you still waiting how the reception will be?
I'm satisfied.
That's great.
Making a film, it's also a little bit like having a child, in that everything that you do for the film is enable the film to have a life, you know, a good life after you've finished it and it's out in the world, however that might manifest. So this film is finished. It's not, I need to go back and I can see its flaws, but I don't go back in there and tinker with them to take them out. Yeah, we're still, I guess, at an early stage of figuring out what kind of a dissemination can we get for the film and get it to receptive audiences. I think it particularly has some educational value, I think, to inspire, for example, high school students. I think that would be a great audience to reach.
Was there anything unexpected that occurred while making the film during the research project? Anything that surprised you, maybe?
It surprised me that we finished it. I mean, as Ulf said, previous films I made, I had a very clear vision from the outset of what the film was. Fireball, for example, which I made with Werner Herzog, I conceived it in a pitch in a couple of weeks, and the final film is pretty much a mirror image of that original concept. This film, it was Ulf's vision to see if we could get a budget from ZIF, from the University of Bielefeld, to make the film. And I certainly thought, you know, eruptions that shook the world is something that I've been interested in for a while. I'm sure we can do something. But I didn't. I guess I had some kind of guidelines, if you like, for how to assemble the conversations that we filmed at ZIF, but not a clear idea of what the finished product would look like. And I remember Ulf in the workshops, he sort of left space half an hour or so for me to update on the progress of the film. And this was, you know, was a little bit embarrassing because there, you know, until you've got all the footage, you don't have a film. I can just show, you know, some of the little bits and pieces. And I'm always sort of, I was hoping, you know, nobody's going to ask me a sort of difficult question. Well, yeah, but what's the film about? Or when's it going to be finished? So they were very kind to me. But it wasn't an easy film to make because you can't offer a film with a dozen people talking. You can make a podcast with that, but not a cinematic film. So I guess the major challenge was to glue this together with something visually arresting that would give it a cinematic feel.
Yeah, because there was not the script, we had no idea. So it was not, can we achieve that? We were even had an idea about that. And I realized the moment at the end, so the project was over, we had all the footage, and then we probably realized a little bit. We also have to keep in mind the budget and everything. I mean, this is a small budget, right? And we were just, I think, smart in the way of how we were benefiting from the workshop budget, basically. So we had all these experts here. I mean, that was one of the motivations in the beginning, but there was no film concept behind. But we just said, look, we have the opportunity to talk to, let's say, 30 world-leading experts. They will come over these 2 years. They will spend a week with us, and we will have a very personal, a very warm, a very open atmosphere. So let's benefit from that. They are here. They have been flying in, traveling to Bielefeld from all places around the globe. They spend time with us. We give them this atmosphere of scientific exchange. Let's capture that on camera. So we knew that, right? But that does not mean that then how, what to do with that later. And I always thought it's easy. And then at the moment when we had it, it was much more difficult. And then the other advantage, huge advantage, and we would have never been able to create something if Clive wouldn't have had this whole archive of footage and also the connection and the network. And I think what we basically achieved is only thanks to Clive's expertise, really, I think the skill and vision of getting that together, plus your network and the archive of footage. And I mean, we have to be very honest, right? If it would just have been me or anyone else who has no experience and you give the person this amount of money, you cannot expect to get something similar out. That's impossible. So I have almost a feeling we paid just a fraction of the real budget, and the rest, also when you said like you worked a year on that, right? That is unpaid work. We have to name it as it is, right? And I'm only saying that not that we get more credit. No, no, I think we have to be careful that we are not now having expectations that each group that will come here in the future with a similar budget is able to achieve such a high-end product. Not because they are not good, but I think there is a lot of peripheral and pre-work that you could include that a normal person simply does not have.
I mean, there are moments of serendipity as well, which partly just when you're editing and you see something that just, like the diamond that catches the light just by chance, it's in a particular direction. But one of my moments of joy making the film, relatively late in the day, so I sort of begun to assemble our cast of protagonists, and I knew Anna Gudjonsdottir, our Icelandic artist, would be the first protagonist, not talking about how volcanoes change the climate, but actually reflecting on having been amongst our group and having observed the scholastic exchange and seeing actually how there were echoes in that with the practice in art and in music. So I had an artist who's at the beginning of the film, and I'd thought that Lachesee would be the volcano where we see a volcano, we see the rocks, and that would also provide some glue for the film. And I knew there was a monastery at Lachesee, and I'd always, you know, sort of imagining the final scene, you know, we're invited in to dinner by the monks, and that's the closing. So we arranged, this is pretty much the last bit of filming, to spend a day at Lachesee. And the email exchange, there would be one monk, Bruder Stefan, who would speak to us on camera. And so I think I'm flying out on the Thursday or Friday to film on a Saturday. And just before heading out, I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think monks would be on the internet, you know, but I'm just going to look up Brother Stefan just in case, you know, I can find out. I like to do a little bit of research into the people that I'm going to meet and film on camera. And there he was. And why was he there? Because he's an artist. And then I thought, wow, that's amazing, because I have an artist at the beginning and now an artist at the end. And they're both from, Anna says she was born in the volcanic fissure. And Brother Stefan, who spent his life at this monastery right inside the crater of the site of a colossal eruption 13,000 years ago. So, yeah, I was so excited when I saw he was an artist and that this would give a kind of mirror from beginning to the end of the film. So little things like that just come to make your day and make your job as a filmmaker easier.
Now that the film is finished, what are your plans? How can the listeners, if they maybe want to watch it, can they watch it somehow?
We're trying to see if we can get any distribution, and we've got one or two contacts to follow up in the near term, and that makes us hesitate from making it freely available at this stage, because then I think if we can get some formal distribution, then the film will get a bit of marketing and it'll get some publicity from which we can leverage perhaps a wider audience. But I don't think they'll touch it if it's already on YouTube. So at the moment, it's not freely available. But that is our, not long-term aim, I would say medium-term aim, hopefully sometime next year. It's just, you know, you can reach through a portal on the ZIFF website. And certainly I'm happy to be contacted for screening for educational purposes in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. If it is available, we will add it to the show notes so that the listeners will know.
Wonderful, yeah.
Okay. Anything else you would like to talk about, to touch on, that I haven't asked or mentioned?
I think I'd just mention that again, that we had, as I say, it was a wonderful place to film architecturally. And a lot of documentaries, the protagonists will be filmed with a very bland brown background, the kind of thing that you'd have in a graduation photograph, something very, you know, nothing, absolutely featureless. The fact that this space isn't featureless, I think, made it super interesting. And Ulf and I think this is our seventh visit to ZIFF. It is like coming home for us, and that's not just the place, it's the people here. I could have credited everyone who works at ZIFF, all our fellows who are involved in the project. It's all there in the film. It's in the ethos of the film. So, yeah, locations, protagonists, as Ulf said, you know, casting is important, and I think it came together.
So, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll see you again, who knows?
I hope so, yeah. I know. We're always plotting the next thing, aren't we?
I made a few notes. Yeah. For me, it was a very good experience. At ZIFF also, seeing that we can actually make a film here. And I also think that the topic of the workshop invited us to make a film on it. So that was more a clear thing. As we also said, right, we had this idea about the topic and the research, and we knew that that is not bad for a film. And then the rest came, and Clive said it very well, that was a very good space here. And I could clearly see if we make another one, a second one on a different topic, it would probably be easier. Is that correct, Clive? Because we know a lot of things now, and if you do things for the very first time, it's always more difficult. And
I'd agree up to a point, except I would say in some sense every film is the first time. I don't think you want to just have a formula. You know, I think you face the challenges again of what's the originality, what's the different perspective. The other thing I just realized, when film was in some ways a culmination of film I'd been trying to make for back at the end of the 90s, I was working on a book, Eruptions That Shook the World, then, and I conceived of it as a documentary, and I did contact someone at the BBC, and over the following decade, there were probably a number of independent film documentary production units. I had some discussions with them. It never got past a commissioning editor. And I ended up finally getting a commission to make a film actually with ZDF. It was going to be two parts, Eruptions That Shook the World. They were going to use some kind of animatronics software to make me speak native German. So I was going to present this thing. So this, you know, I think this was, you know, after at least a decade, and I finally got this thing. But it was the same time that I'd persuaded Werner Herzog to make a film together. And the production were very keen that I wasn't involved in these two things. So I had to drop the ZDF, which they did go on. It does exist. Eventually, another 10 years later, eventually, the volcanoes and climate and history story is told. So it was a long journey.
Yeah, I hope more people will get to see it. I like the, I think, probably the little stories within the whole picture of the researchers and how they approach their topics and maybe how they even got interested in it. And I think it gives a very good insight into how research can work. Thank you again. Thank you for the film, for being here.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.